Welcome back. This is the Paula Gordon Show. Bill Russell and I are honored and delighted to have Dr. John McGuire with us. You also wrote an op-ed piece many, many years ago in the state of New York that was picked up, and you ended up talking with then-Governor Nelson Rockefeller that ended up really opening the doors to higher education. Open admissions was something that nobody had ever heard of, but you made it very clear in a public way that the people of the state of New York were paying for higher education and ought to have access to it. Now, I'm not sure I told the story the way you would tell it, but this notion of one guy saying, it ain't right, and doing it publicly in the New York Times in this instance, and then major things happening in the society. Was that a time that you felt really empowered? That was a big thing you did.
Full of hubris and arrogance, maybe more than power. I look back on it with great amusement when I realized I'd never spent a day in a public university, a day of my life. I was a creature 100% of private higher education, Washington and Lee, Yale. Let's remind ourselves that it was the 1960s, and in fact, it was in the spring of 1960. And that image of the accessibility of a public library was already emerging in my mind, that higher education ought to be for anybody at all ages. It should not be for 18 to 22-year-olds alone.
Who are privileged economically.
In the state university, they tried to do a little better with that by a very much lower fee structure. Didn't even call it tuition, just called it fees in those days. But still, it was prohibitively expensive for lots of people. And no one had waked, really, to the explosion of demographic change in the major cities. The astonishing consequence of that piece was Governor Rockefeller's meeting me and telling me that New York ought to have a public experimental college. Three or four states had already started. Santa Cruz is the experimental campus of the University of California. Evergreen State in Washington State. Green Bay in Wisconsin. So New York did not lead the way, but it was one of the first to experiment. And Rockefeller had bought a wonderful, intact 600-acre estate on Long Island, the Ambrose Clark estate, the family that are the heirs of the great Singer sewing machine fashion. So it was one of the great North Shore Long Island estates, a very unlikely but lovely setting to do a third world poor people's college. And many people both talked about and resented the fact that suddenly 70% of the students were of color, that the median age was 30 years old. So for every 19-year-old, there was a 48-year-old studying full-time at the same time. Wonderful mixture of women of wealth who'd gone to Vassar 2 years, 20 years before, had raised their families, were now wanting to go back and complete baccalaureate degrees, sitting right next to recent immigrants from the Dominican Republic, from Puerto Rico, from the American South who had moved north, African Americans to New York City. And so it was in every sense a regional college. It really drew from the greater New York area. But it was a fascinating experience, and it certainly was the highlight in just the dynamism of my own higher ed career, because all these convictions I'd had, which were a little maverick and somewhat strange, were allowed to be realized, and that's, after all, I was the president. Now, I quickly learned that is not worth anything. I mean, if ever
that in a quarter, right?
That presidency requires persuasion, not power. That was it. I learned many, many, many lessons. But I was gratified that toward the end of the decade I was there, Old Westbury was pretty well nationally recognized as a kind of living laboratory for what has become what we think of as the urban university. There'd been predecessors, City College of the City University of New York, San Francisco State. I mean, you think of immediately of a half a dozen of these, but it became the pace setter, I think, because we worked so relentlessly on the concept of it. There was an instance of uniting thought with action. We've struggled on what a place that had that mission ought to do and be.
And there's nothing wrong with struggle, is there?
That's been the story of my career.
And we learn from it. I mean, I get the sense, at least in America in the beginning of the 21st century, that we would really like everything to be easy.
Well, I love it. We commissioned the students at Old Westbury to do a banner, a school motto, and I love the motto they came up with, where duty and pleasure are one. I thought I could work with that motto. But they did a banner, and the banner was in La Luca Continua, the struggle continues. So of all the things you could have chosen as your school motto and put it on a banner, Old Westbury chose the struggle continues.
You raise an interesting concept. We have a friend who characterizes himself as a public theologian, and we've talked with people who characterize themselves as public intellectuals. The idea, and I think of John Adams' absolute insistence on the necessity, not as a frill, but the necessity of education.
You mean John Adams, our third president, second president.
Not the composer.
No.
He would probably insist on it, too. But, how important the learning process is, but not only the learning, but the sharing of the learning. And it goes back to what you were talking about earlier at Claremont and what you did in New York. The importance of not only having the knowledge, working with the knowledge, developing the knowledge, but also sharing that knowledge and providing leadership.
Absolutely. Let me just note, Bill, however, where that tension lies today, I think, with that. I totally subscribe, in fact, have written pieces about the public intellectual. And I think what that has come to mean in many quarters is writing about subjects beyond your own trained specialization, engaging broader social issues, the economics of our time, the culture of our time. In that sense, being a very wide-ranging thinker and writer in your thought. But there are relatively few that go on and do and are out in the streets as well. There are notorious exceptions to that and positive ones. But I do think we still are now bedeviled by specialization to the point that we wonder, why is Professor X out there on the picket line? Isn't that a little too far to go? We love to hear X write on these subjects and appear in op-ed pages of papers and popular magazines, not just scholarly journals. But I think it's very rare, and we talk about the career of Martin Luther King. King once said early on, I had to give up being a scholar. I tried to the end to remain an intellectual, but I care too much for the craft. I respect the craft of scholarship to the point that I know you can't pursue it and live the kind of life I'm called upon to live. And that is the tension. That is the tension of sleeplessness, of being on planes, of being in corridors of power, of lobbying, of being in public roles. And I don't think we have much in models for there are very few people who put that together, because what you happens psychologically is if you gain recognition for your role, in that sense maybe celebrity, you're constantly being interviewed and you're tired, you're exhausted, you invent the soundbite, the short quip that's arresting, and to be able to find the leisure, and then even if you carve out the leisure, unite it with the energy to be able to do more elongated, further, more horizon-like thinking, that's very hard to do. That's hard to put those two roles together. And what I don't hold my own life as model by any means, but the only way I've been able to do that is almost by alternation. That is to say, where periods where one of these faces on the world, one of these modes of being, is more dominant than the other. So periods of contemplation, writing, essaying, then periods of just flat-out action, pushing in the street.
This is John McGuire, and I will let Bill Russell continue this conversation when we return in just a moment. Please do be with us for the Paula Gordon Show.